Vorlach Vorbach Reads. Produced by the Cincinnati and Hamilton County Public Library.
Welcome to a new season of Vorlach Vorbach Reads, a Cincinnati and Hamilton County Public Library podcast. The last 2 years, I have read some of the scariest poems containing supernatural elements in them, as well as covered some of the historical famous events that happened in the same year that the poems were published. This year, I'll be returning to my roots, the short story, or in some cases, like in today's podcast, an excerpt from a novel. Now, I will not be relating to historical events anymore, but I will give a brief bio of the author. We are going to begin this season in 1764 with the very first Gothic novel, The Castle of Otranto by Horace Walpole. Horace was an English writer, art historian, and politician. He had built Strawberry Hill House, which revived the Gothic style long before it became a Victorian craze. Upon having a nightmare, and having studied medieval history, Walpole wrote and anonymously published The Castle of Otranto, the defining work of what would be called Gothic literature, creating several key tropes commonly used: the cursed family history, a haunted castle, secret passages, trapdoors, paintings moving and doors shutting all by themselves. So let us start at the very first chapter of The Castle of Otranto by Horace Walpole. Chapter 1. Manfred, Prince of Otranto, had one son and one daughter. The latter, a most beautiful virgin, aged 18, was called Matilda. Conrad, the son, was 3 years younger, a homely youth, sickly, and of no promising disposition. Yet he was the darling of his father, who never showed any symptoms of affection to Matilda. Manfred had contracted a marriage for his son with the Marquis of Vicenza's daughter, Isabella, and she had already been delivered by her guardians into the hands of Manfred, that he might celebrate the wedding as soon as Conrad's infirm state of health would permit. Manfred's impatience for the ceremonial was remarked by his family and neighbors. The former, indeed, apprehending the severity of their prince's disposition, did not dare to utter their surmises on this precipitation. Hippolyta, his wife, an amiable lady, did sometimes venture to represent the danger of marrying their only son so early, considering his great youth and greater infirmities. But she never received any other answer than reflections on her own sterility, who had given him but one heir. His tenants and subjects were less cautious in their discourses. They attributed this hasty wedding to the prince's dread of seeing accomplished an ancient prophecy, which was said to have pronounced that the castle and lordship of Otranto should pass from the present family whenever the real owner should be grown too large to inhabit it. It was difficult to make any sense of this prophecy, and still less easy to conceive what it had to do with the marriage in question. Yet these mysteries or contradictions did not make the populace adhere the less to their opinion. Young Conrad's birthday was fixed for his espousals. The company was assembled in the chapel of the castle, and everything ready for beginning the divine office, when Conrad himself was missing. Manfred, impatient of the least delay, and who had not observed his son retire, dispatched one of his attendants to summon the young prince. The servant, who had not stayed long enough to have crossed the court to Conrad's apartment, came running back breathless in a frantic manner, his eyes staring and foaming at the mouth. He said nothing, but pointed to the court. The company were struck with terror and amazement. The Princess Hippolyta, without knowing what was the matter, but anxious for her son, swooned away. Manfred, less apprehensive than enraged at the procrastination of the nuptials and at the folly of his domestic, asked imperiously what was the matter. The fellow made no answer, but continued pointing towards the courtyard. And at last, after repeated questions put to him, cried out, "Oh, the helmet! The helmet!" In the meantime, some of the company had run into the court, from whence was heard a confused noise of shrieks, horror, and surprise. Manfred, who began to be alarmed at not seeing his son, went himself to get information of what occasioned this strange confusion. Matilda remained, endeavoring to assist her mother, and Isabella stayed for the same purpose, and to avoid showing any impatience for the bridegroom, for whom, in truth, she had conceived little affection. The first thing that struck Manfred's eyes was a group of his servants, endeavoring to raise something that appeared to him a mountain of sable plumes. He gazed without believing his sight. "What are ye doing?" cried Manfred, wrathfully. "Where is my son?" A volley of voices replied, "Oh, my lord, the prince, the prince, the helmet, the helmet." Shocked with these lamentable sounds, and dreading he knew not what, he advanced hastily, but what a sight for a father's eyes. He beheld his child dashed to pieces, and almost buried under an enormous helmet, 100 times more large than any casque ever made for human being, and shaded with a proportionable quantity of black feathers. The horror of the spectacle, the ignorance of all round how this misfortune had happened, and, above all, the tremendous phenomena before him, took away the prince's speech. Yet his silence lasted longer than even grief could occasion. He fixed his eyes on what he wished in vain to believe a vision, and seemed less attentive to his loss than buried in meditation on the stupendous object that had occasioned it. He touched, he examined the fatal casque, nor could even the bleeding, mangled remains of the young prince divert the eyes of Manfred from the portent before him. All who had known his partial fondness for young Conrad were as much surprised at their prince's insensibility as thunderstruck themselves at the miracle of the helmet. They conveyed the disfigured corpse into the hall without receiving the least direction from Manfred. As little was he attentive to the ladies who remained in the chapel. On the contrary, without mentioning the unhappy princesses, his wife and daughter, the first sounds that dropped from Manfred's lips were, "Take care of the Lady Isabella." The domestics, without observing the singularity of this direction, were guided by their affection to their mistress, to consider it as peculiarly addressed to her situation, and flew to her assistance. They conveyed her to her chamber, more dead than alive, and indifferent to all the strange circumstances she heard, except the death of her son. Matilda, who doted on her mother, smothered her own grief in amazement, and thought of nothing but assisting and comforting her afflicted parent. Isabella, who had been treated by Hippolyta like a daughter, and who returned that tenderness with equal duty and affection, was scarce less assiduous about the princess. at the same time, endeavoring to partake and lessen the weight of sorrow which she saw Matilda strove to suppress, for whom she had conceived the warmest sympathy of friendship. Yet her own situation could not help finding its place in her thoughts. She felt no concern for the death of young Conrad, except commiseration. And she was not sorry to be delivered from a marriage which had promised her little felicity, either from her destined bridegroom or from the severe temper of Manfred, who, though he had distinguished her by great indulgence, had impressed her mind with terror, from his causeless rigor to such amiable princesses as Hippolyta and Matilda. While the ladies were conveying their wretched mother to her bed, Manfred remained in the court, gazing on the ominous cask, and regardless of the crowd which the strangeness of the event had now assembled around him. The few words he articulated tended solely to inquiries whether any man knew from whence it could have come. Nobody could give him the least information. However, as it seemed to be the sole object of his curiosity, it soon became so to the rest of the spectators, whose conjectures were as absurd and improbable as the catastrophe itself was unprecedented. In the midst of their senseless guesses, a young peasant, whom rumor had drawn thither from a neighboring village, observed that the miraculous helmet was exactly like that on the figure in black marble of Alfonso the Good, one of their former princes in the church of St. Nicholas. "Villain, what sayest thou?" cried Manfred, starting from his trance in a tempest of rage, and seizing the young man by the collar. "How darest thou utter such treason? Thy life shall pay for it." The spectators, who as little comprehended the cause of the prince's fury as all the rest they had seen, were at a loss to unravel this new circumstance. The young peasant himself was still more astonished, not conceiving how he had offended the prince. Yet, recollecting himself, with a mixture of grace and humility, he disengaged himself from Manfred's grip, and then, with an obeisance which discovered more jealousy of innocence than dismay, he asked with respect of what he was guilty. Manfred, more enraged at the vigor, however, decently exerted, with which the young man had shaken off his hold, than appeased by his submission, ordered his attendants to seize him, and, if he had not been withheld by his friends, whom he had invited to the nuptials, would have poignarded the peasant in their arms. During this altercation, some of the vulgar spectators had run to the great church, which stood near the castle, and came back open-mouthed, declaring that the helmet was missing from Alfonso's statue. Manfred, at this news, grew perfectly frantic, and, as if he sought a subject on which to vent the tempest within him, he rushed again on the young peasant, crying, "Villain, monster, sorcerer! 'Tis thou hast done this! 'Tis thou hast slain my son!" The mob, who wanted some object within the scope of their capacities, on whom they might discharge their bewildered reasonings, caught the words from the mouth of their lord, and re-echoed, "Aye, aye, 'tis he! 'Tis he! He has stolen the helmet from good Alfonso's tomb, and dashed out the brains of our young prince with it!" Never reflecting how enormous the disproportion was between the marble helmet that had been in the church and that of steel before their eyes, nor how impossible it was for a youth, seemingly not 20, to wield a piece of armor of so prodigious a weight. The folly of these ejaculations brought Manfred to himself. Yet, whether provoked at the peasant having observed the resemblance between the two helmets, and thereby led to the further discovery of the absence of that in the church, or wishing to bury any fresh rumor under so impertinent a supposition, he gravely pronounced that the young man was certainly a necromancer, and that till the church could take cognizance of the affair, he would have the magician whom they had thus detected kept prisoner under the helmet itself, which he ordered his attendants to raise, and place the young man under it, declaring he should be kept there without food, with which his own infernal art might furnish him. It was in vain for the youth to represent against this preposterous sentence. In vain did Manfred's friends endeavor to divert him from this savage and ill-grounded resolution. The generality were charmed with their lord's decision, which, to their apprehensions, carried great appearance of justice, as the magician was to be punished by the very instrument with which he had offended. Nor were they struck with the least compunction at the probability of the youth being starved, for they firmly believed that, by his diabolical skill, he could easily supply himself with nutriment. Manfred thus saw his commands even cheerfully obeyed, and appointing a guard, with strict orders to prevent any food being conveyed to the prisoner, he dismissed his friends and attendants, and retired to his own chamber, after locking the gates of the castle, in which he suffered none but his domestics to remain. In the meantime, the care and zeal of the young ladies had brought the Princess Hippolyta to herself, who, amidst the transports of her own sorrow, frequently demanded news of her lord, would have dismissed her attendants to watch over him, and at last enjoined Matilda to leave her and visit and comfort her father. Matilda, who wanted no affectionate duty to Manfred, though she trembled at his austerity, obeyed the orders of Hippolyta, whom she tenderly recommended to Isabella, and inquiring of the domestics for her father, was informed that he was retired to his chamber, and had commanded that nobody should have admittance to him. Concluding that he was immersed in sorrow for the death of her brother, and fearing to renew his tears by the sight of his sole remaining child, she hesitated whether she should break in upon his affliction. Yet solicitude for him, backed by the commands of her mother, encouraged her to venture disobeying the orders he had given, a fault she had never been guilty of before. The gentle timidity of her nature made her pause for some minutes at his door. She heard him traverse his chamber, backwards and forwards, with disordered steps, a mood which increased her apprehensions. She was, however, just going to beg admittance, when Manfred suddenly opened the door, and, as it was now twilight, concurring with the disorder of his mind, he did not distinguish the person, but asked angrily who it was. Matilda replied, trembling, "My dearest father, it is I, your daughter." Manfred, stepping back hastily, cried, "Begone! I do not want a daughter," and, flinging back abruptly, clapped the door against the terrified Matilda. She was too well acquainted with her father's impetuosity to venture a second intrusion. When she had a little recovered the shock of so bitter a reception, she wiped away her tears to prevent the additional stab that the knowledge of it would give to Hippolyta, who questioned her in the most anxious terms on the health of Manfred and how he bore his loss. Matilda assured her he was well, and supported his misfortune with manly fortitude. "But will he not let me see him?" said Hippolyta, mournfully. "Will he not permit me to blend my tears with his, and shed a mother's sorrow in the bosom of her lord? Or do you deceive me, Matilda? I know how Manfred doted on his son. Is not the stroke too heavy for him? Has he not sunk under it? You do not answer me. Alas, I dread the worst. Raise me, my maidens. I will see my lord. Bear me to him instantly. He is dearer to me even than my children." Matilda made signs to Isabella to prevent Hippolyta's rising, and both those lovely young women were using their gentle violence to stop and calm the princess, when a servant on the part of Manfred arrived and told Isabella that his lord demanded to speak with her. "With me," cried Isabella.
"Go," said Hippolyta, relieved by a message from her lord. "Manfred cannot support the sight of his own family. He thinks you less disordered than we are, and dreads the shock of my grief. Console him, dear Isabella, and tell him I will smother my own anguish rather than add to his."
As it was now evening, the servant who conducted Isabella bore a torch before her. When they came to Manfred, who was walking impatiently about the gallery, he started and said hastily, "Take away that light and be gone." Then, shutting the door impetuously, he flung himself upon a bench against a wall and bade Isabella sit by him. She obeyed, trembling. "I sent for you, lady," said he, and then stopped, under great appearance of confusion.
"My lord?"
"Yes, I sent for you on a matter of great moment," resumed he. "Dry your tears, young lady. You have lost your bridegroom. Yes, cruel fate. And I have lost the hopes of my race. But Conrad was not worthy of your beauty."
"How, my lord?" said Isabella. "Sure you do not suspect me of not feeling the concern I ought. My duty and affection would have always..."
"Think no more of him," interrupted Manfred. "He was a sickly, puny child, and heaven has perhaps taken him away, that I might not trust the honors of my house on so frail a foundation. The line of Manfred calls for numerous supports. My foolish fondness for that boy blinded the eyes of my prudence, but it is better as it is. I hope in a few years to have reason to rejoice at the death of Conrad."
Now I'm going to skip a little bit of ahead, because there's this kind of icky part where Manfred basically tells Isabella he's going to marry her instead, and she runs away like any smart person would. So we will pick up at that point. At these words, he seized the cold hand of Isabella, who was half dead with fright and horror. She shrieked and started from him. Manfred rose to pursue her, when the moon, which was now up and gleamed in at the opposite casement, presented to his sight the plumes of the fatal helmet, which rose to the height of the windows, waving backwards and forwards in a tempestuous manner, and accompanied with a hollow and rustling sound. Isabella, who gathered courage from her situation, and who dreaded nothing so much as Manfred's pursuit of his declaration, cried, "Look, my lord, see, heaven itself declares against your impious intentions."
"Heaven nor hell shall impede my designs," said Manfred, advancing again to seize the princess. At that instant, the portrait of his grandfather, which hung over the bench where they had been sitting, uttered a deep sigh and heaved its breast. Isabella, whose back was turned to the picture, saw not the motion, nor whence the sound came, but started and said, "Hark, my lord, what sound was that?" And at the same time made towards the door. Manfred, distracted between the flight of Isabella, who had now reached the stairs, and yet unable to keep his eyes from the picture, which began to move, had, however, advanced some steps after her, still looking backwards on the portrait, when he saw it quit its panel and descend on the floor with a grave and melancholy air.
"Do I dream?" cried Manfred, returning. "Or are the devils themselves in league against me? Speak, inferno spectre! Or if thou art my grandsire, why dost thou too conspire against thy wretched descendant, who too dearly pays for..." Ere he could finish the sentence, the vision sighed again and made a sign to Manfred to follow him.
"Lead on," cried Manfred. "I will follow thee to the gulf of perdition."
The spectre marched sedately, but dejected, to the end of the gallery, and turned into a chamber on the right hand. Manfred accompanied him at a little distance, full of anxiety and horror, but resolved. As he would have entered the chamber, the door was clapped to with violence by an invisible hand. The prince, collecting courage from this delay, would have forcibly burst open the door with his foot, but found that it resisted his utmost efforts. "Since hell will not satisfy my curiosity," said Manfred, "I will use the human means in my power for preserving my race. Isabella shall not escape me." That lady, whose resolution had given way to terror the moment she had quitted Manfred, continued her flight to the bottom of the principal staircase. There she stopped, not knowing whither to direct her steps, nor how to escape from the impetuosity of the prince. The gates of the castle, she knew, were locked, and guards placed in the court. Should she, as her heart prompted her, go and prepare Hippolyta for the cruel destiny that awaited her? She did not doubt but Manfred would seek her there, and that his violence would incite him to double the injury he meditated, without leaving room for them to avoid the impetuosity of his passions. Delay might give him time to reflect on the horrid measures he had conceived, or produce some circumstance in her favor, if she could, for that night at least, avoid his odious purpose. Yet where conceal herself? How avoid the pursuit he would infallibly make throughout the castle? As these thoughts passed rapidly through her mind, she recollected a subterraneous passage which led from the vaults of the castle to the church of St. Nicholas. Could she reach the altar before she was overtaken? She knew even Manfred's violence would not dare to profane the sacredness of the place. And she determined, if no other means of deliverance offered, to shut herself up forever among the holy virgins, whose convent was contiguous to the cathedral. In this resolution, she seized a lamp that burned at the foot of the staircase and hurried towards the secret passage. The lower part of the castle was hollowed into several intricate cloisters, and it was not easy for one, under so much anxiety, to find the door that opened into the cavern. An awful silence reigned throughout those subterraneous regions, except now and then some blasts of wind that shook the doors she had passed, and which, grating on the rusty hinges, were re-echoed through that long labyrinth of darkness. Every murmur struck her with new terror, yet more she dreaded to hear the wrathful voice of Manfred, urging his domestics to pursue her. She trod as softly as impatience would give her leave, yet frequently stopped and listened to hear if she was followed. In one of those moments, she thought she heard a sigh. She shuddered and recoiled a few paces. In a moment, she thought she heard the steps of some person. Her blood curled. She concluded it was Manfred. Every suggestion that horror could inspire rushed into her mind. She condemned her rash flight, which had thus exposed her to his rage, in a place where her cries were not likely to draw anybody to her assistance. Yet the sound seemed not to come from behind. If Manfred knew where she was, he must have followed her. She was still in one of the cloisters, and the steps she had heard were too distinct to proceed from the way she had come. Cheered with this reflection, and hoping to find a friend in whoever was not the prince, she was going to advance when a door, that stood ajar at some distance to the left, was opened gently. But ere her lamp, which she held up, could discover who opened it, the person retreated precipitately on seeing the light. Isabella, whom every incident was sufficient to dismay, hesitated whether she should proceed. Her dread of Manfred soon outweighed every other terror. The very circumstance of the person avoiding her gave her a sort of courage. It could only be, she thought, some domestic belonging to the castle. Her gentleness had never raised her an enemy, and conscious innocence made her hope, that unless sent by the prince's order to seek her, his servants would rather assist than prevent her flight. Fortifying herself with these reflections, and believing, by what she could observe, that she was near the mouth of the subterraneous cavern, she approached the door that had been opened. But a sudden gust of wind that met her at the door extinguished her lamp and left her in total darkness.
Thank you so much for listening to Warlock Vorabach Reads, a Cincinnati and Hamilton County Public Library podcast. Such melodrama, huh? But, nevertheless, that was the springboard novel for so many more fantastic, supernatural, and horror stories to be published. In fact, if you are looking for a more recently published gothic novel, may I suggest Mexican Gothic by Sylvia Moreno Garcia. This fantastic novel has everything you want: a house that haunts your dreams, a strong female protagonist, a mysterious family past, and, well, mushrooms. So go to our website and place it on hold, or call us or visit your local library branch. Next time, we will read from the most popular gothic novelist of her day, someone I already had on this podcast before. Till next time.
Thanks for listening to Warlock Vorabach Reads. Subscribe to this podcast right now so you don't miss future episodes. And discover more of our podcasts at chpl.org/podcasts.